Shoreshin Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everyone. This is Bill, and this is our Torah commentary on Ve'etchanan. Ve'etchanan, which is in Devarim, or Deuteronomy, chapter 3, verse 23, going to chapter 7, verse 11. As we begin this portion, Moses is explaining to the people how he prayed to the Lord, not necessarily to continue being the leader of Israel, but simply to cross the river, to walk into the land, and to see it, because by this time, Joshua is already designated as his successor. So it's interesting to see that even Moses was prevented from going into the land because of disobedience, because he didn't sanctify his name in the sight of the people, that is, the Creator's name. But in verse 25, he says that he wanted to see this good mountain. In Hebrew, Hahar Hatov. Hahar, the mountain, Hatov, the good mountain, which is very specific. And so we'll assume that the mountain that he's referring to is directly across from where he is standing. That means then that he's talking about mountains around Jerusalem. And some traditions understand this specific mountain that he's referring to is, of course, the Temple Mount, where the Creator would put his name, Mount Moriah. It's interesting that Mount Moriah in Hebrew is Bahar HaMoriah. Bahar, mount, or mountain, HaMoriah, the Moriah. Moriah is from the term, or believed to be from the terms, Reah, Yah. Reah, seen, or to see, Yah, of course, referring to the Creator. And so Genesis 22 calls it the land of Moriah. That's before Abraham names it. It's called the land of Moriah, and of course Moriah is Mem Resh Yud He. Mem Resh Yud He. The word teacher in Hebrew is More, and More is Mem Vav Resh He, which is from the root Mara Mem Resh He. So my point is that this good mountain that he's wanting to see is probably referring to the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah. And Moriah is referred to or is related to the term Moreh or teacher. And of course, the teacher is Moshe. And the teacher, Moshe, the Moreh, is anxious to see Moriah. And why is he anxious to see Moriah? Because that's where the teaching will truly come from. The Torah shall go forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Yerushalayim. Specifically, hinting at Moriah. Now, one commentator notes that Moses' life is somewhat defined by mountains. In the Horeb, he's called to be a leader. Sinai is where he received the Torah on the behalf of Israel. Nebo is where he looked into the land. And then, of course, later on in the New Testament, on the Mount of Transfiguration, that's when he stood with the Messiah. Yet after all of this pleading to go and to see the land, we see that God didn't listen to him and basically told him to be silent. That's enough. But instead, he was to command Joshua to do what Moses would not be allowed to do. In chapter 4, verse 1, he tells them to hearken. That is to not just listen, but to hear. And to hear, of course, or hearken, in this particular case, is the Hebrew shma. Shma. To truly internalize what I'm saying. More than just listening. In the previous Torah portion, we talked about the differences between listening and hearing. Messiah told people, who has ears to hear, let him hear. Well, everybody had ears, but what he was saying is, really internalize what I'm saying. So Moses tells them in verse 1 of chapter 4, Shema, listen, hear, hearken to these statutes. Literally, these engraved decrees. Why? In order to do them. The main purpose of teaching someone something is to provoke them to do it. So his purpose of teaching is to provoke others to do. Not learning, but doing is the principal thing according to the ethics of the fathers. Again, we spoke of this in the previous Torah portion, Devarim. They were in Mount Sinai for a long time, learning. But there comes a point in time, he says, enough of this. You're at this mountain long enough. Now's the time to start doing the principal thing, if you will. That is, possess the land. Do these things that I've told you to do. And when you do these things, you may live, and you will possess the land. In verse 2, Moses counsels us that we should not add, nor shall you subtract. Because if you try to add to what God has said, if you try to take away from God's word, it's if you're saying you're trying to improve upon God's word. The word add here is derived from the root word yasaf. By the way, yasaf is where we get Yosef or Joseph. And it means to augment. It means to add. It means to increase. The word diminish or subtract is from the root word gara. And that is a word that also means to restrain, to lessen, even to scrape off. So what have people done? They have added to. They have augmented. They have diminished. They have restrained. They have lessened. They've scraped off the stuff they don't like. But we're told we're not to do that. But to the contrary, we are to keep or to literally guard these commands, which is impossible if we're adding to them or if we're taking away from them. By the way, as you know or should know, that adding to and taking away is the tactic of the adversary from the very beginning. In Genesis 3, verse 4, then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." If I may paraphrase, you will know everything that God knows. But to bring her to that point, he took away from what the Creator had said, and he added to what the Creator had said. He had said, "You won't die," but the Creator said, "You will die." So he took away from what he said, and then he added to, "Look, you'll just know everything he knows." That is the tactic of the adversary, who in Genesis 3 is the serpent, Nachash, who is subtle, who is crafty, who is clever. And the Hebrew term there is Arum. Arum is related to another word, and that word is Aram, which is the word used when Adam ate of the fruit, he realized he was naked. Aram. So, in a sense, when Adam ate of this mingled fruit, he begins to emulate the traits of the serpent. That is, mankind, after we fell, began to add to God's word and take away from God's word. And that's why we have so many different religions, so many different denominations, so many different ideas of what is truth, because we add to, we take away. We augment, we restrain, we lessen, we scrape off. Moses likens the admonition of not adding to or taking away to the sin of Baal Peor. In other words, it's equivalent. And of course, this is recorded for us in Numbers chapter 25, but what was it? It was mingling with the women of Midian, mingling with the women that were coming in to seduce Israel away from the truth. And he says, "You went to the sacrifices of their gods, and these people who were involved with this sin were destroyed from your midst." And so once again, he likens the adding to and the taking away, which is mixing, to the sin of Baal Peor. And so we see how the Creator feels about mixing and mingling. The mixing with other seed is equivalent to adding to and diminishing from his word. And the result will be the same as well. So Moses reminds them that you saw, and you saw these things. And why are you alive? Because you didn't do it. You didn't participate in it. That's why you're alive. To keep these commands is what is going to distinguish Israel from the nations. And so, in essence, what you have is a bunch of slaves who are rising to prominence as a nation. They have a sound society, they have a moral society, and that, of course, as it prospers, is going to attract the attention of other societies. And so then the nations around them would acknowledge that Israel is a nation that possesses wisdom and understanding, if you will, there being a light to the nations, which that is their purpose, and that's why they have to possess the land But in order to possess the land, you have to keep the commandments without adding to, without taking away. And I'm tempted, well, I will, to point out that the reason our nation at this point in time is, I believe, degenerating and falling apart, really, is because we added to, we took away from those principles that brought us forth as a nation, and specifically those principles that are based upon biblical principle. And where in times past we may have been a light, so to speak, and I use that not in a synonymous way with what Israel is called to do, but we have been a light as a nation in some respects. But that light is diminishing now. Why? Because we've added to, we've taken away from those fundamental principles that caused us to be a sound and moral society, a nation possessing wisdom and understanding. Well, that's what Israel was supposed to do. And so Israel, if they wanted to be that nation, should not add to, should not take away. In verse 8, Moses points out that no other nation has laws such as this that are righteous and just. So in verse 9, he says, keep your soul diligently, basically telling Israel that their survival as a people is dependent upon keeping these instructions and remembering what they saw with their own eyes at Mount Sinai. And so then in verses 11 and 12, he recounts what they saw at Mount Sinai. He describes it for them, the mountain burning with fire, the smoke, the darkness. And so in verse 12, he says, and the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form, only a voice. Now, something to me that's very interesting about this, the way this is worded, it hints at a tradition concerning the events of Mount Sinai. And that is that God's voice was divided into tongues of fire that were visible to the people who were there. Why is that interesting? Because that is exactly what we see in Acts chapter 2, cloven or divided tongues of fire that appeared to those who were present. Still, they saw no one. They didn't see anybody, yet they knew he was in their midst. So this emphasizes that God was giving them a covenant of fire, that is at Sinai, and it was engraved in stone. So in verse 15 and 16, he says, take great heed to yourselves. Since they saw no form, they were not to portray him using any type of image. He spoke to them, he was present among them, but they didn't see an image. And so in other words, don't try to turn him into an image. And in my belief, that's exactly what they did at Sinai with the golden calf. They took something that was equated with Egypt, and they used it not so much to worship an idol of Egypt, but to use what they were familiar with to represent the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So then in verse 16, he stipulates no images, male or female. There's no Hebrew word for goddess, and so he says, don't make any images that are male or female. So as we continue, in verse 19, he says, lest you lift up your eyes unto heaven and be drawn away and worship these things that are in heaven, the host of heaven. And the host of heaven, of course, was a dominant influence in Babylon and Egypt and all of these other societies. And they used these luminaries as symbols of deities. But he said, don't do that, lest you be drawn away, to be lured away by their brightness, by their magnificence, by their mystery. Because people are typically attracted by things that are mysterious and by things that shine and sparkle. And that is exactly why we see the adversary comes as an angel of light. He says, don't be drawn away by these things, which the Lord has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. Allotted is the Hebrew word chalak. It means to divide, to portion, to designate. And so some interpret this to mean that these luminaries were given to the nations to enjoy their light, to enjoy their heat, and that was their only source of light, which is distinguished, of course, from Israel. Isaiah 60, verse 19 says, the sun shall no longer be your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give light to you. But the Lord will be to you an everlasting light, and your God your glory. In other words, Israel receives its light not from these luminaries primarily, but from the Creator. The light that first appeared at the beginning before there was a sun, moon, or stars that were brought forth, of course, on day four. But the light that is from the beginning is day one. And so, again, Israel is to receive its light not from these physical luminaries necessarily, but to receive its light from the Creator. And so don't look to the sun, the moon, and the stars, the host of heavens, as deities, as gods, as things that would lure you away from the fact that He is your light. Some sages suggest this means much more than that. Some imply that He says that these are allotted to these other nations because it's been designated to them to be worshipped by them. And I'm not saying I agree or disagree. I'm just saying that's what these particular commentators bring out. In other words, that God allowed the heathens to worship the sun, the moon, and the stars. And some would imply the reason He allowed them to do that was as a stepping stone to bring them to Him, to bring them to this higher stage of belief. Again, I'm not agreeing with that. I'm not going to be dogmatic and say I necessarily disagree with it. If that is true, it could be supported by the fact that Avram was in Ur, becoming Abraham of Canaan. It is true that many of us grew up believing things that we've since discovered are wrong. Yet those things, those beliefs, served a role. It served a part in bringing us to where we are. So there's something to be said for that. Again, whether the opinion of the rabbis that they were given to the peoples of the nations to be worshipped, I'm not going to say I agree with that necessarily, but I will agree with the fact that there are things that we have looked at, that we've believed in, that we have since found to be wrong, that have brought us to the place of understanding what is true and what is right. Kind of in conjunction with this concept is the fact that rabbis state that the war that was declared against the Canaanites was not because of their dogma, but because of their cruelty and the debauchery that their beliefs led them to. Other heathen nations were not placed on the same level as Canaanites. Canaanites stand out head and shoulders as far as cruelty and, well, debauchery among many other nations. The Romans, the Persians, and other empires obeyed certain laws of conduct, pagan though they may be, but they did obey certain laws. But the Canaanites are lawless, essentially. These other nations, on the other hand, they were following in the ways that had been taught them, wrong though they may be, mixed though they may be. But Canaan, they were cruel, they were vicious. Sages differentiate that approach from what was given to Israel. Israel had first-hand knowledge. These other nations, the Romans, the Persians, they had things handed down to them by other people. They inherited this, that, and the other. Hearsay, if I can use that word. But Israel had first-hand knowledge. They heard from the Creator Himself. There is only one way that leads to life, however. These other nations, even though they may have certain laws that were handed down to them, that they inherited from others, nevertheless, that does not negate the fact there's only one way that leads to life. And so I'm not endorsing or implying that it's okay to be amongst these other nations and to participate in what they participate in. No, I'm not saying that at all. There is only one way that leads to life. And Israel is that nation that is given firsthand knowledge of how to walk in life and how to walk in blessing in order that Israel may fulfill its mandate to be a light to those nations who are maybe keeping laws but are also doing other things that are their way of thinking. That's Israel's purpose. Israel receives firsthand knowledge, and now Israel is to walk out that they have received in order to be that light to teach these other nations their error. Not necessarily by invading those other nations and conquering them and then enforcing Israel's laws upon them, but by living in the land of Israel according to God's instructions, so that the people around them will see that they are a sound and moral society, that they have wisdom, that they have understanding, and that's why they're prospering. Isaiah 42, verse 5 through 7. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the prison, those who sit in darkness from the prison house. Now, ultimately, this is speaking of the Messiah, Yeshua. He is the head, but what pertains to the head is going to affect the body as well. And so Israel is called to be this light to the nations who are blind, who are in prison. They are imprisoned to their beliefs, their customs, their laws. They're blind to what is true, what is light. And of course, this is reiterated in Isaiah 49, verses 3 and 6. But notice that this is spoken by the one who created the heavens and everything in them. He is the one who has allotted these luminaries to the nations. Now notice what Paul has to say about this subject in Romans chapter 1. And I'm going to read from the Complete Jewish Bible beginning in verse 20 because I like the way he put it. For ever since the creation of the universe, his invisible qualities, both his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen, because they can be understood from what he has made. Therefore, they have no excuse, because although they know who God is, they do not glorify him as God or thank him. On the contrary, they have become futile in their thinking, and their undiscerning hearts have become darkened. Claiming to be wise, they have become fools. In fact, they have exchanged the glory of the immortal God for mere images, like a mortal human being, or like birds, animals, or reptiles. This is why God has given them up to the vileness of their heart's lusts, to the shameful misuse of each other's bodies. They have exchanged the truth of God for falsehood, by worshiping and serving created things rather than the Creator. Praised be He forever. Amen. So I'm not so sure about the idea that heavenly bodies were given to the nations to worship. It's understood that they did that, but it was in contradiction to what they knew to be true. In other words, they see the created luminaries and they know that there has to be something behind that or someone behind that. But they do what is right in their own eyes. They refuse to acknowledge that and rather choose to worship the created thing rather than the Creator. So then Israel is called to be a nation that does what is right in God's eyes, not their own. And thus they become a light. They become a luminary to the nations. In verse 20, this is accentuated by the fact that he took Israel out of an iron furnace, out of Egypt. The term is iron crucible. And the crucible is that which is used to purify gold, to purge it of foreign matter. The Hebrew word for furnace is kur. It's kaf, vav, resh. And that verb means to purify, to repair, to correct. And it's related to something that is dug out or it's bored, implying a pit. And this pit is used to serve as a furnace. So you dig this pit, it's going to be used as a furnace. And it's interesting that because there are other words that are rendered furnace too, but the Creator specifically chose this word. Egypt is intense suffering, intended to purge them of these base instincts, to purge them of rebellion, to purge them of the idea that the sun, moon, and the stars, the hosts of heaven, are to be worshipped as deities. So that's this crucible. Egypt and Pharaoh serve the purpose of readying Israel to conform to his will. You see, the Torah places limitations, but not on life. The Torah places limitations on our evil inclination. Egypt's way is to remove the boundaries. But Torah's way, the Creator's way, is to place those boundaries And as we live between the boundaries, we are moral, we are sound, we are wise, we are understanding because we are walking in the way that he is said to walk. We're not doing what is right in our own eyes. And so they saw all these things in Egypt, and then they had to be subjected to all these things of Egypt to see the end result of what Egypt is. It's corruption, it's rebellion, it's base. But still the purpose is to ready a people who will distinguish God's way from that of Egypt and from the world. Israel is to be a people of inheritance, and that inheritance cannot be renounced by Israel. And so this call, this responsibility to be this light, is for all time. In Ezekiel 20, beginning at verse 32, he tells the elders of Israel, even while they're in Babylonian captivity, "What you have in your mind shall never be when you say, 'We will be like the Gentiles, like the families in other countries, serving wood and stone.' As I live, says the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with fury poured out, I will rule over you. You will do what I say to do. You will be my people, one way or the other." In verse 38 of that same chapter, he says, "I will purge the rebels from among you and those who transgress against me. They shall not enter the land of Israel." The context of this verse, of course, is when he gathers all of Israel from the nations, that is, in the last days. But earlier here in our Torah portion, he says that they are coming from the furnace of Egypt, or Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim is related to the idea of pressure, of a trial. In Egypt, they had mingled with the culture. So it will be at the end of days. Israel is supposed to be a set-apart people, a light to those mingled nations, but not to mingle with them. But that's what they did in Egypt. That's what they will do in the end of days. And then that they have assimilated into will be the furnace that is intended to purge these things from them. Look at what Yeshua says to the mixed congregation of Laodicea in Revelation 3, verses 18 and 19. "I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire. Why? That you may be rich, and white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore be zealous and repent." Now consider the furnace of Daniel chapter 3. You have three men who refuse to bow. They rather choose to sanctify his name. But this furnace is heated seven times hotter. Interestingly enough, God's word is like silver that is purified seven times in Proverbs chapter 12. So all of this is to say that these nations, Babylon, Egypt, they serve a purpose. And one of those purposes is it becomes a furnace out of which he brings his people. And that furnace is to serve the purpose of removing the dross, removing all of those imperfections, removing that mixed and mingled mindset in order that they might be a light to those people who are subject to that mixed and mingled mindset. God's people are a people of inheritance, and they are promised, we are promised, that he will not forsake the covenant. 1 Samuel 12, verse 22, "For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you his people." Isaiah 48, verse 10, "Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace," and that word is kur, "of affliction." So affliction is going to refine you. Affliction is the furnace from which Israel comes forth from. Again, why? So that they can teach and be an example and a witness to those who are still in that affliction, who are still in that mingled way of thinking. Now, in verses 21 and 2, Moses was forbidden to go over Jordan, and that was a punishment of his error. He was going to die outside the land. He's going to die on the east side of the Jordan. We glean from this that even though Moses led Israel through the wilderness, it is Joshua, it is Yehoshua who will lead them into the land. Moses, representative of the Torah, led them through the desert. But Yehoshua or Yeshua leads them into the land of their possession. Now, verse 22, when he says, I must die in this land, Rashi makes a comment on that statement and says that what he was meaning was, not even my bones will be carried over Jordan to be laid to rest in the sacred soil, as will happen with the bones of Joseph, which is a very interesting concept. The Talmudic reason that is given for this statement is because Joseph always acknowledged himself as a Hebrew, and Moses at one point in time did not. Now, whether that is true, who can say? It's unclear, but it's possible. So then, interestingly, it is a descendant of Joseph, that is Joshua, that leads them into the land. Still, both of them came out of Egypt. Both of them wandered the wilderness. One was alive and one was dead. Yet when they cross over, the one who had died is now resurrected, and the one who was alive has died. So the crossing into the land, coming into the possession of the land, is emblematic of the one who was dead is now resurrected. Now, I'm not completely sure why Moses' bones were not permitted to be buried in the land. Some people have supposed that the people of Israel would have attempted to build a shrine, and that's very possible, maybe even very likely. But nonetheless, the result is Moses is hidden from plain view. He's hidden. Nobody knows where he's buried at. Here's what I'm hinting at. Moses is hidden from plain view, and yet Judaism accepts him. They believe his words, or they listen to his words, even though they cannot see him. They can't perceive him, yet they believe him, yet they trust him. Judaism believes in the coming of Elijah, though he can't be seen. He was taken up. And it's interesting that these are the two that appear on the Mount of Transfiguration, which is that high unnamed mountain. Of course, Moses comes from the tribe of Levi. Elijah is from the inhabitants of Gilead. And Gilead is a descendant of Joseph. And that, of course, represents the two witnesses. But what are they witnesses of? They are witnesses that Yeshua is the Messiah. They are symbolizing that both the natural and wild branch are in Messiah, who is the one who is not seen. Judaism doesn't see him, and they don't see him, and therefore they don't follow his words, and yet follow the words of Moses, even though they can't see him. They believe in the coming of Elijah, even though they don't see him. So consider, if the belief about Moses is true, then at one point he concealed his identity, while Joseph always acknowledged his identity. And so there are those who are of the natural branch, that Israel who acts like the nations, Egypt. And then there are those who are of the nations who are in Egypt, who strive to behave as the seed of Abraham. And in the end, all will be grafted into Messiah. All will have to acknowledge who and what we are and behave accordingly if we are to enter the land. In verse 23, Moses says, take heed. If Moses is not permitted to enter because of his error, then Israel should take note that God's not going to play favorites. And they should be very grateful that they're being allowed to enter into the land. They're being allowed to enter into their possession, and they should not take that flippantly. And should remember that our God is a devouring fire, which has positive and negative connotations. He's a jealous God, and he doesn't allow the loyalty that is due him to be given to anyone or anything else. Here's an interesting comment from H.G. Wells, the writer of different fictional books. He says that none of the founders of the great heathen religions had any inkling of this idea of a jealous God, a God who would have no other gods before him. Because the cultures of Greece and Rome, of course, worshipped a myriad of non-jealous gods. They coexisted with one another. They mingled with one another. When Jerusalem fell, Rome was actually prepared to give the God of Israel a place in their pantheon of gods, but that couldn't be. And so the Jews were always at odds with Rome. Truth cannot make any concession to falsehood. It can't compromise with it. It can't tolerate it as our culture would have us to do today. Because to do so would be a surrender to the falsehood. And once you've done that, the falsehood is going to grow and expand and eventually is going to try to stamp out the truth. That is why there is the story of Hanukkah. That is why the story of the three Hebrews and Daniel 3 is in our Bible, of their refusal to coexist, to tolerate the falsehood. Cultures of the past and our culture today will cede a belief in God as long as God remains in his proper place. For example, this so-called separation of church and state. We live in a society that says we must allow for other gods, for other views when it comes to God and religion, and we have to be tolerant. Well, according to culture's definition, to be tolerant means that we're going to have to learn to coexist with the falsehood. But because we are told that our God is a jealous God, he will have no other gods before him, we consequently cannot be tolerant. Now, some contend that it should go beyond this, that we have a responsibility to teach there are false gods, there are false ideas. My argument is, yes, but not by pointing a finger at everybody who's participating in this, but by living a life in respect and in obedience to the one and only God, so that people around us will see that we live a moral and a sound life, that we live a prosperous life because of what we do, not because of pointing fingers at others. There is a legend that Abram began his journey by smashing idols in opposition to everyone else. And while on one hand I would agree that putting down these idols is important, I also want to consider that they were only told to smash the idols that were in the land of Canaan, not the other lands. They were actually told to respect the borders of Edom, Moab, Ammon, and some of these others. And so, yes, while on one hand it's important to rid our culture of the false gods, it's more important to teach through our lies of the one true God. You see, by knowing the truth and living the truth, the lie is easily discerned. And if I live the truth, then I become a light, and those who are in darkness will see light. Consider Paul's actions in Athens in Acts chapter 17, verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. So he's agitated. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. Then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods, because he preached to them Yeshua and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean." For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious, for as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you." So were they truly worshiping without knowing him? That's something to consider. The main point, though, is Paul didn't break their gods. He didn't smash them into smithereens. He didn't necessarily demean them for their false worship. What he did was he used what they acknowledged as a means of speaking the truth. Kind of going back to what we said earlier about the sun, moon, and stars and how the nations looked to them as objects of worship and how some people believe that maybe that was a stepping stone. Well, in a sense, what Paul did was he took those things that they did look upon as objects of worship to lead them to the one and only true object of worship. Some heard the truth and some believed. And when they heard the truth, they could discern the falsehood. Yes, there are times to break down the idols, the pillars, the Asherah poles. There are times to expose the lie. But I believe the most important methodology is by simply speaking of and living according to the truth. Verse 25, Moses tells them that after you are in the land for a while, that they would abandon the truth. He tells them, when you do, not if you do. He predicts that this is exactly what they're going to do, and that they will make these graven images in defiance of a jealous God. And they will do that because they have learned this from the inhabitants of the land. And at that time, heaven and earth will be witnesses against them, and that they will be exiled from the land, and they will be scattered. And so in a sense, according to verse 27 anyway, they were scattered before they were even entered into the land. He makes it clear that those who were entering the land would not be as susceptible to this, but it would be in later generations, which is the way it always works. Those who come out of the crucible are the ones who acknowledge the hand of the Creator and who honor Him and try to be obedient to Him. But as they prosper, later generations who are far removed from that crucible forget these foundational principles. They forget those experiences. They ignore them, and then they begin to do things that are right in their own eyes. And so those who did not see these things firsthand, that is coming out of Egypt, it was ancient history to them. Those who didn't see the crossing into the land and all the miracles that took place there, it was ancient history to them. Those who weren't there at the revolution in the 1770s, it's all ancient history to them. So complicating this is the prosperity that they would enjoy in the land. And as we all know, prosperity is like a drug, and that drug dulls our spiritual senses. And so he tells them, you shall have been long in the land. It literally, you have grown stale in the land. Now Yeshua, in referring to the last days, said this of his people, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. That's in Matthew 24, verse 12. And of course, lawlessness is understood to be Torahlessness, because of this culture and society that is without instruction, without Torah, the love of many will cool. It will grow stale. Now, this part of the Torah that we're discussing is actually read on the ninth of Av, and hopefully most of you are familiar with what the ninth of Av is. The ninth of Av is a day of infamy. Many disastrous things have happened on the ninth of Av, one of them being when the people heard the evil report of the spies and they rebelled against God, and of course, it commemorates the destruction of the temple. But this part of the Torah that we're reading, and here's why I'm bringing this out, tells how Israel will go into exile, they will be scattered, and how Israel is to return. If this Torah portion is read on the ninth of Av, and the ninth of Av is most prominently associated with the destruction of the temple, here is an interesting thing to consider. Keeping in mind the context, Israel will be scattered amongst the nations, will go into exile, and how to return. The reason the temple was destroyed on the ninth of Av was because their love had grown cold. Their faithfulness had grown stale. Now, tradition states that the temple stood, that is the temple of Solomon, it stood for 410 years. So now, I'm going to throw something out at you, and I probably shouldn't, but I will anyway. And I'm not going to tell you what I mean. You're going to have to figure out what I'm getting at here. Go and figure out what this means. 1607 plus 410 for the years the temple stood equals 2017. Moses warned Israel that this scattering is, again, going to be the result of their stale love. It's going to be the result of their idolatry. And idolatry, as we know, is equivalent to mixing the clean with the unclean. The golden calf incident is exactly that, mixing clean with unclean. Acts 15 warns against mixing, whether it's idolatry, fornication, eating blood, or anything that's unclean. Thus, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is equivalent to idolatry. And the result of idolatry or mixing is what? Exile. Because when Adam ate of the fruit of that mixed tree, he was exiled. And in verse 28, Moses says, in exile, they would serve gods, the works of men's hands, wood and stone. In order to gain acceptance, probably. But nonetheless, they will become polluted by the nation's or by that society's values. You look at the current situation, or the, I should say, ongoing situation with Israel and with the United Nations. Israel, because it wants to be part of the United Nations, has to learn to coexist with all of their corruption, which, in my opinion, begs the question, why would Israel, considering the UN despises Israel, why would it want to be part of that? Well, extrapolate that out. Why does Israel want to assimilate amongst the nations when the nations hate Israel? So, you will serve other gods when you're in exile because you'll want to gain acceptance. You'll want to be accepted by those nations to which you've been driven. And you'll end up worshiping something that is inferior to humans. Idols of wood and stone. Or let's put it this way, something that is beneath us. And if it's beneath us, then it's under our heel. Remember where the name Israel comes from. It comes from the man Jacob, whose name really means hand on heel. As his people, we are supposed to put our heel on the head of the adversary because the Messiah has already done that. So when we end up worshiping that is those things that are inferior to humans, something that is beneath us, then we end up acting like something that is beneath us. Animals. Look around the culture today and observe what people are doing, how they're acting. They're acting like animals. Why? Because they worship things. It doesn't have to be an idol of wood or stone. It's just in defiance to the Creator, in defiance to His laws, His standards, His morals, His values. When we reject those things by default, we embrace others, and those other things are beneath us. So again, he said this is what's going to happen to you. And this would occur in those other nations, which then are going to end up serving as a furnace. You're going to be part of what's going on there in all these other nations. And then at the appropriate time, those other nations are going to be a furnace. And that furnace is intended to purge you of all of these impurities that you have associated yourself with. And so we have a lot to learn from this scenario. As he's talking to the people who are about to enter the land, he's speaking to people who did not have firsthand knowledge of what happened in Egypt, but are only hearing of these things. And he's warning them that you'll be stimulated by those who are around you who do serve these other gods to be enticed to do the very thing that they're doing. And so consequently, you will mix these other things with the truth. And then once you've mixed these other things with the truth, the result will be exile. But being in exile will bring you to the realization of exactly why he called you out of those nations. Because their ways don't work. Their ways are defiled. Their ways are corrupt. Their ways are beneath you. They're animalistic. And how can you ever help these people? How can you ever be a light to these people if you're acting like these people? So verse 29 tells us, but from there, that is amongst these nations, you will seek the Lord. You will seek the Lord in these nations even as you're surrounded by their idols, and you will find him if you search for him. The word seek or search in Hebrew is bakash, to search for the unknown, to seek something in order to find it. The word find here is mem zadeh aleph, pronounced matzah, matzah, which is kind of interesting, matzah. Not only to find, but when you find, to attain it, to acquire it, and to secure it, but you must search for him. The Hebrew word here is darash, And when you search, you are inquiring, you're demanding, you're investigating. You have the intent of finding the answer. And so if you're on Mars Hill and you see the idol that is ascribed to the unknown God, if you seek the unknown God, intending to find it, if you investigate thoroughly, if you study, if you inquire, you will attain your goal. You will find me. I will make myself known to you. But this can only be done by the one whose heart is determined to find and to understand the answer and to embrace the truth. In Matthew 7, here's what Yeshua said. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, it will be opened. Now, again, going back to something we just said, the word find in Hebrew is matzah, mem zadeh aleph. It's distinguished from the word matzah that we eat at Pesach, mem zadeh hey, yet phonetically it is synonymous. It sounds exactly the same way. Some look at the matzah that we eat at Passover, and they do not see. See what? See the Messiah. Others who search see the matzah, and then they, matzah, mem zadeh aleph, acquire the answer. They find it. They see Yeshua in the matzah that we eat. The disciples that Yeshua met on the road to Emmaus did not see him. They did not discern that he was the Messiah. They saw a man, they saw a stranger, and they talked with him, they interacted with him, but they didn't see him. Luke 24, verse 30. Now it came to pass, as he sat at the table with them, that he took bread, blessed and broke, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished from their sight. So what was he doing when they had their eyes open and they knew him, when they found him, if I could put it that way? He was breaking matzah. Interesting. When is this going to occur? Verse 30, Moses tells us it will occur at the end of days. Acharita yamim. This is understood to mean just before the coming of the Messiah. This is when you're going to seek. This is when you're going to search. This is when you're going to find, just before the coming of the Messiah. It's the same period of time that Daniel writes about in chapter 12 of his book when he refers to the ketz, or the end. And it will happen in your distress. That word is zar, zadeh resh, zar. The King James Version renders it, it will happen in your tribulation. This is when all these things are going to take place. Now, zar, it's a tight place. It's a narrow place. It's a strait. And it comes from a root that means to be oppressed or to be besieged. And this word zar is the word that gives birth to Mitzrayim, or Egypt, which again, remember, is the crucible, the furnace of affliction. And why do you come from the furnace of affliction? To purge all of those things that you decided to associate with and assimilate into, to purge them from you so that you will be that light, so that you will be that witness, that example. But you've experienced it now, and you know its corruptive influence. You know what it leads to, and so you learn to disdain it. He says, you will return to the Lord. And the word return comes from the Hebrew term shuv. In this particular verse, it's spelled shin bet tav, pronounced shavta. You will return, shavta. But this is fascinating. It's spelled identically to Shabbat, shin bet tav. And so it's interesting that this return at the end of days, in spelling, shin bet tav, is tied to Shabbat. What's bringing so many people back to the roots of their faith? It's the whole concept of Shabbat. And Shabbat is a day that is set apart. It's not to be intermingled with all the rest of the days of the week. So what is going on right now, I believe, is a fulfillment of exactly what Moses was saying. You will be amongst these nations, you will be in exile, but you will seek, you will find, you will return. Why? Because in verse 31, the Lord is a merciful God. Even though he's a consuming fire, he's yet a merciful God. To the wicked, the fire consumes. But to the righteous, the fire purges and restores. So in verse 32, Moses begins to discuss this distinct relationship between Israel and between God. And as a consequence of that relationship, Israel has a responsibility. In Psalm 147, verse 19, it says, He declares his word to Jacob, his statutes and his judgments to Israel. He has not dealt thus with any nation. And as for his judgments, they have not known him. In other words, he deals with Israel in a unique way. There is no other nation that he's given his word to. And to accept his word and to live by his word is to come into that nation. That would then mean that God has not given this unique relationship to America. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't raise up the U.S., because I believe he did, and I believe he raised it up for a purpose, but not to be Israel. Maybe, so that as we focus on America and what America was intended to be, and now we see the way that has turned out, or is turning out, that provokes us to look beyond that, to look to what Israel is according to the Creator. In other words, if they were looking at the sun, moon, and stars as objects of worship, eventually they're going to learn that these things are not worthy of their worship, but the one who created them is. And if America has been held up as the standard for so long, and now we see the decline, and I'd say the dramatic decline of America, maybe that has been used to provoke us to look beyond America and to see what the Creator has defined Israel as being, and that is what he is leading us into. So again, he didn't give his word to any other nation except Israel. This unique relationship between the Creator is between him and Israel. And so he, yes, raised up the U.S. and for a purpose, no doubt about it, but it was not to be Israel. That would also include what we call the church. In other words, he didn't give this unique relationship to the church as people define that term. What I mean by that really is this. Those people who are part of the church, who are part of the body, are really, in biblically speaking, part of Israel, not part of a man-made institution or industry, but part of a family that God calls Israel. And so how did he manifest this unique relationship with Israel? Well, with great signs and wonders. One of those, for example, being the splitting of the Red Sea. Verse 35 tells us the reason for this. The purpose was so that Israel would know that the Lord is God and there is no other. A Talmudic interpretation of this includes that they would not put their trust in magical powers, not to have faith in those kinds of things, which would then include curses. For example, Balaam was called to curse, but he couldn't curse. And because he couldn't curse, that implies that others can't curse Israel either. Don't put your confidence in them. Don't fear those things. The Lord is God. There is no other. And he has established his covenant with you. See, this is why I don't believe that true believers can be under a curse that is pronounced by others. But I believe that, like Israel, if we are walking according to his instructions, we're blessed. And what he has blessed, no one else can curse. However, like Israel, we can subject ourselves to other things through disobedience. When we walk in disobedience, we open ourselves up to these things, just like the matter at Baal Peor. They mingled with the daughters of Midian, and they did to themselves what the adversary couldn't do. However, obedience results in blessing upon us. It blesses us, our children, and it prolongs our days, according to verse 40. In verse 37, he said that God led Israel from Egypt as a father leads a son by the hand. And so in verse 39, lay this to heart. People know something intellectually, but they can never take it to heart. But what Moses is saying to them is, all these things I'm instructing you, internalize it until it becomes part of who you are. Many people know things, but they lack the commitment to do them from their heart. And throughout the scripture, we see that the most important thing to the Creator is that He has our heart. The first and great command is, love the Lord your God with your heart, then your soul, then your strength. I'm of the opinion that so many people try to bypass the heart and just love intellectually. As a matter of fact, I believe that those who are denying Yeshua, those who have come into the Hebrew roots, that is, specifically, and they then deny Yeshua as the Word made flesh, are trying to be intellectual about all of this instead of being those who internalize these things into their heart. Now, we're all struggling with this issue. We're all struggling with doing this with our hearts rather than our heads. But we still have to take it to heart. And if Moses told us to do this, and he's speaking in the context of those who would seek and search and find at the end of days, I have to believe that there is going to be a people who are going to take these things to heart. That's the most important issue. Then your head, and then what it looks like on the outside. Now, we're coming into chapter 5. And at the beginning of chapter 5, Moses is going to relate how that never before had a nation witnessed the things that they had. That is, the events at Mount Sinai, the manna from heaven, water from a rock, and being led through this great and dreadful wilderness. And so we are to always be mindful of those things so that we won't forget God and then perish as those nations that Israel is about to dispossess. Paul warns this generation not to make the same mistakes as those who were in the wilderness. In 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, he says, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, hearken, internalize, lest he fall. Moses exhorts Israel to hear the commands and then learn the commands and then do the commands. Again, most of the people that he's talking to now had not been present to hear the voice at Mount Sinai. And so you need knowledge, and you have to have that knowledge before you can perform something. But as I've said many times, knowledge alone is not enough. We need understanding of that knowledge. If the knowledge is the hearing, then the understanding is the learning. Then what is the doing? It's walking it out. And to walk it out, we need wisdom and how to appropriate the knowledge and the understanding. So again, he tells them to hear, knowledge, to learn, understanding, and do, wisdom. Verse 3, he says, the Lord made this covenant, not with the fathers, but with us. Now, some understand this to mean that it's saying not with the fathers alone, but with us too. But us would not be limited to just those who were present there at that time, 3,500 years ago, but with the nation of Israel and forever. God spoke it to Israel then, but those words resound through time to us today. In verse 6, Moses relates the Ten Commands, and these Ten Commands expresses that he, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is the ruler of the universe. He's not just a God who's tied to the wind or to the earth or to the waters. He's the one who created it all, and he rules it all, and therefore he's the one who can command how we are to live. So in verse 6, the first of these ten is, I am the Lord your God. And realizing this, other things will fall into place. Verse 7 is the second command, which, in recognition of the first, that I am the Lord your God, you're to have no other gods before me. Hebrew says, pene, or literally, in my face, which would insinuate that if you have other gods in my face, that will provoke me, just as in the case of Nimrod was provoking him. He was in his face. Korach was before Moses, or in his face, provoking him, rebelling against him, opposing him. Don't have these other gods that are opposing me. that represent rebellion against me. In verse 8, he says they're to not have any manner of likeness. This is to imply that the worship of the true God in any form of any image is wrong. And of course, as I've said before, this is essentially what happened with the golden calf. They were mixing the two. Even though they wanted to use something that they were familiar with from Egypt and to have it represent the God that Moses was speaking to, the end result is still idolatry. Don't do it. Verse 9, he says, don't serve them, suggesting that images that would incite worship are prohibited. Now, here's an interesting thought. A lot of people have a problem with any kind of image, but this is, by saying don't serve them, it's suggesting that don't make any images that would incite worship. Here's why I bring that out. What were made to go on top of the ark? What images were on top of the ark? The cherubim. What was placed under the basin in the temple of Solomon? 12 bronze bulls. The images of bulls. Here's what I'm getting at. It seems that this instruction, this command, is not a prohibition on art. It's a prohibition about making, forming, crafting anything that would inspire or is intended to inspire others to worship something or someone. However, when art has tried to portray God, who is not seen, the picture is something other than God. Yet the significance of God is given to it. Here's what we're talking about: religious icons, a crucifix, the Sacred Heart, even pictures of the Messiah. We've got to be reminded that he is a jealous God, and he visits the iniquity on the third and fourth generations of those who hate him, but mercy to the thousandth generation of those who love him and keep his commands. And so what do we notice about that? His anger lasts a short time, but his mercy lasts forever. In verse 11, we have the third command. You shall not take the name of the Lord in vain, or avoid oaths. The Hebrew word take is from the root word that means to exalt or to lift up. You shall not exalt or lift up in vain, leshav, for vanity or for falsehood, which comes from a root word that means to be desolate or to devastate. In other words, don't lift or exalt the name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in order to desolate or to devastate. Don't invoke the name of the Creator to facilitate or to legitimize something that's untrue or something that has a destructive intent, which would include and be synonymous with mingling holy, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, with profane things, profane interests, methods, purposes. Now, within the context of swearing by heaven, earth, or Jerusalem, here's what Yeshua said. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Those tempted to invoke the name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, as if to say, what I'm about to tell you is the truth, and I'm going to invoke the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, according to the Messiah, they are being led astray by the adversary. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. If you mean yes, then let it be that way. And if it's a no, then let it be that way. You don't have to add his name onto it as if to say, now, that makes it the truth. Because a lot of people say, you know, the Lord told me this, or, you know, the Lord told me that, as if to substantiate what they're about to tell you is truth and it's beyond any kind of doubt or beyond question. Messiah seems to say that when people do that, that they're actually being influenced by the evil one. And so that too, see, is part of profaning the name. And so obviously it's much more than just mispronouncing the name. As a matter of fact, my opinion, I don't think mispronouncing the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh has anything to do with taking his name in vain or profaning it. In fact, it's actually speaking to his authority and his holiness rather than how you pronounce. Do I believe there's a correct pronunciation? Yes, I do. But do I believe that all the emphasis that has been placed upon the proper pronunciation is what he is talking about? No. Don't use his name for vain or destructive purposes. Don't use it to substantiate your opinion. If you have an opinion, state your opinion. If you think this is what things should be, then state it. If you think it shouldn't be that way, then state it. But don't, for other purposes, invoke his name. That too is profaning his name, because that has the potential to be used for destructive purposes. And quite frankly, and in my opinion, that's exactly what many people are doing. They're invoking his name for destructive or vain purposes. Now, the fourth command says, observe the Shabbat. Literally, it says to guard the Shabbat. And guard is from the Hebrew word shamar. Now, in Exodus, it was to remember or zachar the Shabbat. But here it is to guard it. To zachar, to remember it, speaks of doing those positive things concerning Shabbat. But to observe or to guard it means to avoid those negative aspects so that you don't profane it. In verse 15, to help in the obligation to remember and to guard the Shabbat, recall that you were slaves in Egypt, but yet God brought you out of Egypt. In Egypt, you were enslaved and you worked day after day without any rest. So distinguish work from slavery, because you are to be an eved, a bondservant. Yeah, you're going to work, but you're not a slave. You're a servant, a bondservant. And so as a bondservant, don't impose on others that which you despised in Egypt. The rabbinical interpretation notes that here, Shabbat is linked to the Exodus from Egypt, but when it's mentioned in Exodus, it's linked to creation. And so then, Kiddush speaks of Shabbat as a commemoration of Exodus from Egypt, but it also refers to the remembrance of the work of creation. Creation is the establishment of a house, which is symbolized by the Beit of Breshit that comes out of darkness. The Exodus is calling forth a people, a nation, out of the iron furnace in order to forge that house. In verse 16, we have the fifth command, which is honor father and mother, that your days may be long, and so that everything will go well with you in the land, hinting that a very strong and healthy national life is dependent upon a sound family life. And if that be the case, America is in big trouble. Now, the last five commands are linked together with the conjunction an, or ve, the vav in Hebrew. To demonstrate, first of all, one is not to prioritize human relationships. All human relationships are important. To break one suggests that you might be more inclined to commit the other. And so that's why these are all connected with ve, or and. Verses 17 through 20, you don't murder. Don't commit adultery, don't steal, or bear false witness. False is the same word that is translated vain in verse 11, which means to desolate or to devastate. Don't give devastating witness, or don't give witness in order to devastate or to destroy. Tell the truth, yes, but don't have vain or ulterior motives. In verse 21, we have the 10th command, don't covet your neighbor's wife or his belongings. In verse 22, it says that God gave these things to you with a great voice, and then it went on no more, because they couldn't bear to hear more. And so they said, if you'll just go speak with him, we will hear and we will do. And then look at what Moses tells them in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 28 and 9. Then the Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me. And the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people, which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. But oh, that they had a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. In other words, Moses did end up communicating those things to them that God wished them to hear. And those things begin in Exodus 21 in Mishpatim, or the laws of a bondservant. But notice that God already knew it really wasn't in their heart to do these things. Because what becomes evident, what's in their heart, is to make the golden calf and to say, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Now, verse 32, he says that you shall not turn aside to the right or left, which implies what? You go straight ahead, which to me is reminiscent of the crossing of the Red Sea. He brought them down into the mouth of the gorges, which means they had to go through a gorge, which means a ravine, a canyon, in that part of the world, probably a wadi. But nonetheless, they can't turn to the right. They can't turn to the left. They go straight. And then he opened up the sea and in effect is extended this straight and narrow path where they can't turn to the right. They can't turn to the left. They have to keep going straight. And so obviously implying this, we are to walk in the way that God has paved for us. We are to walk in the way that he has commanded us. The steps of a good man, a tzaddik, are ordered of God. They've already been established. And that is the only way that we are going to live, to prosper, and to possess the promise that he's made to us. Now, as we come into chapter 6, after relating these 10 commands, Moses proceeds to declare to us the fundamental creed of Israel. That is, the oneness of God and Israel's loyalty to him. Now, it's important to note that the first command, the first of the 10 commands, is, "I am the Lord your God." Because without a God who commands, there is no teeth to the commandments. So many people don't want to believe the commandments of God and live by the instructions of God because they choose to believe there is no God. And if there's no God, then there's no responsibility to keep his commandments. And if there's no God, there's no consequence if I don't. So there has to be a God who is in command because that's what gives the teeth to the commandments. The Shema, which is our central creed, is said twice daily, and it consists of three different sections. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9, which we have here. Deuteronomy 11, verses 13 through 21, which we'll discuss later. And Numbers 15, verses 37 through 41. The second part addresses the promise of reward for obedience and the punishment for disobedience. The third part is the law of the tzitzit, and it warns against the evil inclinations of the heart. But here, in the first part, "Hear, O Israel," we're told, "the Lord our God, the Lord is one." That sums up the first two commands that we're given. Now, at this point in time, only Israel acknowledges this. Only Israel recites the Shema. But in time, all the world will acknowledge. In Zechariah 14, verse 9, "And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be, the Lord is one, and his name one." The word "one" there, of course, is the word echad. I wanted to bring this out because the word "one" or echad in regards to the Creator is problematic for some who follow Yeshua because they find it difficult intellectually to understand how one God is nevertheless Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, my view is this. It's perhaps as simple as this, that we're talking about something that's beyond human comprehension. As I've said many times before, how do you explain the unexplainable? How do you define the indefinable? Rabbi Gedaliah Shor likened it to this: a ray of light seen through a prism. Though the viewer sees a myriad of different colors, it is a single ray of light. Likewise, God's many manifestations, which I would include here, the Word made flesh, are truly one. In the Shema, the Ayin of the word Shema, Shin Mem Ayin, and the Dalit of the word Echad, Aleph Chet Dalit, are enlarged in the text. And the reason is, when combined, these two letters, Ayin Dalit, form the word Ed, or witness. Because those who declare the Shema are the true witnesses of the one true God. The Dalit of Echad, not necessarily the enlarged Dalit that we just referred to, but the Dalit of Echad is also to distinguish it from another word, that is Acher, which is spelled Aleph Het Resh. And the Resh and the Dalet are very similar in the way they appear. There's just a slight distinction between the two. But the point was, Echad means one, Acher means another. And so if the Dalet of Echad were exchanged for the Resh, and the enlarged Dalet were exchanged for an enlarged Resh, then the word would be Acher. Acher, another. In other words, the Lord, our God, the Lord is another. And so it's very important to see that everything is as the Creator gave it to us. Nothing's added to, nothing's taken away. Because the word Acher is a derogatory term within the context of when we're speaking of God. Exodus 34, verse 14. For you shall worship no other God. The word is Acher. You shall worship no other God, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. If the Resh in Acher, here in Exodus 34, 14, were changed to the Dalet, then it would be mistakenly read, you shall not worship the one God. So again, it's very important that we not add to, that we don't take away. Likewise, the Ayin of Shema, Shin Mem Ayin, to hear, is distinguished from Shin Mem Aleph, Shema, which means perhaps. If you exchange the Aleph for the Ayin, it would say, perhaps the Lord is one. But the point is, exactly as it's written, stated exactly the way it's supposed to be stated, and I would interject this from the heart. The bottom line is, He is one because there is no other. And He is one because He is wholly unlike anything else. And so then, verse 5, and you shall love, ve'ahavta. You shall love Him. God wishes His servants to love Him. Now the one who fears Him may leave Him if His duties overwhelm him. But the one who loves Him makes sacrifices so that he may keep the commands of his master. Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments. And so to be Yeshua's witness, it must be based on this, that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is one. To love him with all your heart, soul, and strength. And then he said, there is another like unto it, to love your neighbor as yourself. And upon these two is what all the others hang. And so our motivation to obey Him must be something that comes from our heart because we have internalized His word. And this is the essential principle in the laws of an Eved or a bondservant. He serves his master forever, not because he fears him, not because he thinks he's cruel, but because he loves him. And if he loves him, I dare say it's because he recognizes his mercy, his long-suffering, his true love, his virtues. Love distinguishes his true followers from those who go through a religious exercise. And if we love him in this manner, to obey him, we are also to love our fellow man. And how are we to do this? With all your heart. Because your heart is the seat of emotion. It's the seat of desire. And unfortunately, it's also the seat of evil inclination. Now, evil inclination doesn't necessarily have to mean rape, murder, mayhem, those kinds of obvious things, but evil inclination can also include craving of food, drink, pleasures. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul talks about how Israel lusted after evil things, and we tend to think that's the most obvious things, but the most obvious things are not the most common forms of wickedness, because they also lusted after meat. They were sick of the detestable bread. They wanted meat, and so he gave them quail. But what's interesting is they didn't leave one hoof behind. They had flocks and herds with them. So they weren't really craving meat, per se, as much as they were craving meat that came from Egypt, because the quail came from the direction of the sea from which they had just come, meaning, or implying, because quail don't come out of the water, they came from the direction of Egypt. So the evil inclination they had was for the things of Egypt, not because quail is inherently evil. but it was because they were craving things that Egypt had to offer, which was suggesting their hearts were still in Egypt. So then, we're to love him with all of our heart, because the heart is the seat of evil inclination. And so then we are to channel these cravings into his service. For example, enjoy what we eat, but within the parameters set forth by the Creator. Ambition, passion, even anger is to be channeled into his service. We're to love him with all of our soul, with all of our faculties, with all of our intellect, with all of our thoughts, even if this requires your life. In Revelation 12, we have a passage that talks about those who overcome the adversary by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and because they love not their lives even unto death. We're to love him with all of our strength, that is, our resources, those things that are tangible, those things we can do. Verse 6 says that these words shall be upon your heart. In other words, inscribed as if upon a tablet, that they would not be removed. Interesting to me, the two stone tablets that were kept in the Ark of the Covenant were called Luchot Ha'idut, or literally the witness stones. Remember, Ed, Aleph Dalet is the word for witness, and this is the enlarged letters in the Shema. And so these things are to be inscribed upon our heart. Our heart is bearing witness to these things being true. Now there is a promise made that these things will indeed one day be written upon our hearts. In Jeremiah 31 verse 33, we're told, "But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law, my Torah, in their minds, and I will write it upon their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This follows the example of the Messiah, who is alluded to in Psalm 40, which says this in verse 8, "I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law, your Torah, is within my heart." Moses then tells us that we are to be diligent in teaching these things to our children, when we sit down at home, when walking down the street, when we're lying down to go to bed at night, recite the Shema. When we awake in the morning, we're to recite the Shema. We're to teach these things to our children. And in verse 8 and 9, he tells them that we are to bind them for a sign, or tefillin, to post them on our doors and our gates, the mezuzah, which, by the way, the mezuzah contains this section of the Shema. And, of course, on the mezuzah is the shin, the Shaddai, shin dalet yud, which is an acrostic for the guardian of the doors of Israel. Because when we do what we are supposed to do, he will do what he has promised to do, symbolizing that God is watching over a people, his people, as a shepherd watches over his flock. Now, as we continue, Moses warns us not to forget. He reminds them that the prosperity that is awaiting them in the land, don't let that dull your spiritual awareness. Prosperity is as great a test, I believe, as a people can encounter. And it's much more seductive than poverty. And all you have to do is look at America and see what I mean by that. In verse 13, he says, "You shall fear the Lord your God as well as love him." Love motivates people to serve. Fear is a deterrent to stay away from evil. Verse 14, it warns them not to go after these other gods, and especially those gods of the people that live around them. The danger of adopting the practice of the heathen nations around them is immediate, and it's more likely, as opposed to the gods of people who are in some great distance. Remember back to the rebellion of Korah, and those of Reuben who were also at the same time rebelling, Dathan and Abiram, who were of the tribe of Reuben. And Reuben's camp was in close proximity to Korah's camp because he was a Kohathite, and both camps were south of the tabernacle. They were close together. And then look what happened. Not only was Korah rebellion, but so were Dathan and Abiram. So this close proximity to these other nations and their gods puts you at immediate risk if you're not diligent to stand guard. In verse 18, he says, "You shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord." It's not enough to be right in our actions. It's not enough to have strict adherence to the law. There is a higher justice than that. In other words, do what is right rather than be right. Because the letter allows for strict, harsh, rigid adherence to the law. But Yeshua says there are weightier matters in Matthew 23:23. Those are justice, mercy, and faith. And those things are not things that can typically be perceived by intellect, but by the heart. You consider the woman caught in adultery. Yeshua didn't dispute what Moses wrote. He carefully judged the situation and extended mercy and then said, go and sin no more. So what I'm getting at is, rather than being right, we should do what is right in God's eyes. In fact, the Talmud teaches that Jerusalem was destroyed because of strict adherence to the law. But it didn't regard equity and mercy and justice. In verse 20, Moses says, when your son asks, what are these commandments? In today's world, the son would say, why are we so different? Why do we have to do this? And why can't we be like everybody else? Moses says that later generations are going to come and they are only going to hear from the family all that has happened. And so then, when they ask you this question, recall all those things that transpired in Egypt as if they happened to this generation, to make it real to them. In verse 24, we are to stress these things that he commands us, that they are for our good, and nothing but good will come about as a result of our obedience. Now, we may encounter things that we don't understand, that are difficult, that are troublesome, but in the end, we will see they are for our good. And in verse 25, if we do as he's commanded, it will be as righteousness unto us. And that's why I believe he tells us that Abraham was considered righteous, because he did what was good in God's sight. He did things his way. He was someone who would hear what God would say and he would do what God said. And in Genesis 15, verse 6, we read, and he believed in the Lord and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now we come into chapter 7, in verse 1, he said that the Lord shall cast out nations before you, literally to make room for Israel, because there are seven nations in the land, or in the area, that are greater and mightier, yet God will drive them out. And in verse 2, he says, he shall utterly destroy them. They will be considered cherim. And cherim is something that isn't to get close to you because it's banned. It's devoted for destruction. And so consequently, you're not to make a covenant with them that would allow them to stay, because they're going to continue their evil practices and eventually they're going to pollute Israel. Now, let me ask this question here. Does this prohibition have ramifications for the situation in the land today? In other words, the covenants and the peace treaties. In my opinion, it does have ramifications. This is the covenant with death, and it has meant that for many, many Israelis. Death at the hands they seek to make peace with. Now, in verse 3, he says, you shall not arrange marriages with them. Don't mingle with them. Don't mingle with the other seed. The patriarchs understood the dangers of these kinds of marriages. Abraham sent Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac among his kinsmen. Isaac sent Jacob away to his kinsmen, or to his wife's kinsmen, in order to find a wife. The dangers are present in Genesis 6. I believe, and I won't expound upon it here, that the sons of God represent what is holy, and then they marry the wicked, corrupt daughters of men, and as a result, we have a flood that destroys mankind, beasts and fowl of the air, etc. So the principle is, don't mingle with them. Don't assimilate in with them. Don't mix holy with clean. Paul echoes this principle when he says, don't be unequally yoked, because light and darkness don't mix. Now, he says this not because of racial issues. It's not for racial purposes. Moses says this not because of racial issues. He's not saying don't marry them because they're a different ethnicity. Don't marry them because they're of a different seed. They're of a different mindset. They worship other gods. And if you allow this mixture, your sons and daughters will be turned away from God. But instead, Israel was to break down their altars. They were to smash their pillars, cut down their asherim, their trees, their poles, and burn their idols. Let me point this out again. This commandment is given for the land of Canaan. It's not given for Edom, Moab, Ammon, and all those other nations. It's given for the land of Canaan. But why were they supposed to break down all these altars, smash all these idols? Because Israel is to be a holy people, his own treasure, segula, literally jewels. In Exodus 19, it's the term that's translated peculiar treasure. Now in verse 7, even though they have this unique relationship and unique law and destiny, if I could use that word, verse 7, Moses makes it clear that he did not set his love upon you because you were more. The term love there is cheshek, and it's understood to be a non-rational love. And it's something that's due solely to the desire of the lover, and there's no other explanation for it. He just loves you just because he decided he wants to love you. He didn't choose you because you were more. He chose Israel because Israel's the fewest. It's the smallest fragment of the world. The most seemingly insignificant fragment, remnant of the world there is. Yet, Israel is chosen to accomplish something that will affect the entire world. That is to be a light to the nations. Which then reminds me of the parable that Messiah gives us concerning the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13, verse 31. Another parable he put forth to them saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which is indeed the least of all the seeds. But when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." So he chose Israel not because they were the greatest or most important, but because they were most insignificant, seemingly. But yet they are chosen to do great and mighty things. In verse 8, he chose Israel because he was committed to keeping his oath that was given to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And verse 9, he says, "No, that God is faithful to keep his covenant, to keep his oath, to keep his promise." And because of that, he extends mercy, and he loves the ones who keep his commandments, who respond to his faithfulness by being faithful themselves. He will be merciful to them. He will love them and to 1,000 generations. And if there are 40 years in a generation, that means 40,000 years. And if that's the case, then that means longer than any man, longer than mankind itself has been around. In other words, he extends mercy and love eternally. Amen. That brings us to the close of this Torah portion. Thanks for joining us. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.